Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. History has shown that making the adjustment from G.I. Joe to Ordinary Joe has never been easy. And this generation of new Iraq War veterans are no exception. There are reports of substance abuse, marital problems, flashbacks, and other signs that whatever happened on the battlefront, all is not well on the home front. Tonight on Point, the continuing emotional battle for the soldiers back from Iraq. We begin with the latest developments in Iraq. 180 people, including an Iraqi colonel, have been detained in a series of major US military raids in Baghdad and right across the center of the country. Edmund Andrews is a reporter for the New York Times. I asked him if these raids were a direct response to the attacks last week on American soldiers.
This was a military and intelligence operation, but it was very clearly also an attempt to put on a display of power and force to opponents of the coalition. So they definitely had the attacks in mind when they lined all of this up. Officers that I talked to in the course of those raids made it very clear to me that they had collected all of the potential targets that were in their files almost and just decided to go after them. And the reason that they did that was to mount not just a few raids here and there for the purposes of collecting or identifying potential opponents, but to put on a really big display that would be felt over a large swath of territory that would really get attention. And that was what they were fundamentally trying to do. So there was a police military aspect to this, but there was also an intent to send a message that we won't stand for this.
It obviously was a very significant military exercise. Thousands of troops, hundreds of tanks, even aircraft involved, I understand. The message, as you suggest, was designed to be clearly understood. But did they find any of the people or any of the things that they hoped they might find?
My impression thus far is that they have not actually made any major arrests. They have arrested a lot of people or detained them, but there is nothing that they have said yet that indicates a real breakthrough in all of this. The results from the first wave, and that was the most intense wave, that began at 2 a.m. or so on Saturday morning, those results were extremely modest.
Is there a contradiction in any sense, do you think, between sending a message of this kind? You quoted one U.S. officer in your piece this morning as saying that the message was, don't mess with us. Is there a contradiction between that and what we've been told now over many weeks is the need to, in the phrase, win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people?
There is a tension between those two goals. There's no question about it. They have a real problem on the hearts and minds front. These kinds of operations inherently are terrifying to the people who experience them. The knock on the door comes in the middle of the night, literally in the middle of the night, after 2 a.m., when people are sleeping, is a very frightening thing to go through. And, of course, everybody tells everybody else about what happened to them. The Americans and the British are keenly aware of the political aspects of this, and so they work very hard to make these raids, have the element of surprise, but at the same time, be civil. And from what I have seen, most of the encounters are remarkably smooth and polite and civilized. But it's a terrifying thing, nonetheless, to go through. I remember watching a group of women and their children huddled in one room, and you had a child who excreted over himself. He's just so frightened. The mother begged that her child not be traumatized. The soldiers do what they can, but if you have a huge squadron of heavily armed soldiers marching into your house, there's no way that can look friendly or civilized.
Ed, I want to ask you about what's been happening in the southern city of Najaf, which is a very holy city to Iraq's Shia Muslim majority. The governor there has been dismissed by the Americans. Why?
this is quite a stunning story. The governor was installed by the coalition forces by order of Paul Bremer himself. The plans for conducting an election in Najaf were canceled at the last minute. The military had actually been rather directly and heavily involved with trying to organize the elections in a systematic way, and they were pretty close to getting started, and then the elections were called off because the question was whether the extremists would win the elections and therefore cause trouble to the coalition forces. The governor was installed by the Americans in this context. He's a Sunni Muslim in a heavily Shiite area, I mean, a Shiite holy city. And now it turns out that the governor, if we are to believe what we're told, was guilty of a wide range of crimes, basically fraud, theft, forcing employees to commit crimes, to steal money, even kidnapping.
There has also, I understand, been a statement from a prominent Shia cleric in the area to the effect that loyal Shia Iraqis should have nothing to do with the Americans, should not cooperate with them in any way?
That is correct. The Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who is probably the most influential and important spiritual leader of the Shiites in Iraq, issued a fatwa, a religious edict, saying that the occupation authorities are not entitled to name the members of an assembly, that means the political council that Paul Bremer had in mind, they're not entitled to name the members of the assembly charged with drafting a constitution. What made Ayatollah Sistani's statements important is that he has thus far worked very hard to establish himself as a spiritual leader and not as a political leader, and he has stayed out of the political debate. So when he weighs in with a statement like that, that's a serious issue for the Americans.
Ed, no one ever supposed that this exercise was going to be an easy one by any means, but it's difficult to avoid the conclusion, isn't it, after the last few days, week or so, that the coalition forces, the American-led administration, are having a very, very difficult time at the moment in Iraq.
It has been a bad week or two for the coalition forces. They are definitely being wrong-footed on a number of fronts. And the situation is so complex and so fast-moving that you absolutely can't predict where it is going to go.
Is it your impression that there is a plan, that somebody there knows what it is they want to achieve and how they may best be able to achieve it?
I do think they have a plan. I think they have fundamental ideas about trying to, in some way, at some point, establish democracy and establish a liberal market economy modeled on Western European American lines. But the details along the way are extremely difficult, and obviously they have not been prepared for many of the challenges that they have been confronted with.
Do you have the impression that the opposition that they're facing is organized opposition from some kind of underground anti-US, maybe pro-Saddam grouping, or is it simply different people in different parts of the country taking opportunities as they find them to demonstrate their opposition to being occupied by a military force from outside?
All of the above. There obviously is some very organized opposition. There is no question that there is some kind of underground Ba'athist element that is trying to systematically make life miserable for the coalition forces. But there's also a lot of opportunism involved. That's exactly the question that we are trying to figure the answer to, and the U.S. intelligence and the British intelligence are trying to figure out, too. Who is behind all this? And I think the answer is it's actually a wide variety of players with different agendas.
Ed Andrews in Baghdad, thanks very much indeed for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Edmund Andrews is a reporter for The New York Times. He spoke to me from Baghdad. The war in Iraq has been short, but it has also been sharp. For many US soldiers, it was their first experience of risking their own lives and taking the lives of others. They have gone through something that the rest of us can only imagine. Now, some of them are back home, back to their families and to daily routines. For some, the transition has been an emotional minefield. Tony Perry is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times who, during the war in Iraq, was embedded with the 1st Marine Division. In a recent article entitled Home is Where the Hurt Is, He described the anguish that can sometimes accompany what should be a veteran's joyous homecoming. Has one of your family been in Iraq? What has their homecoming been like? Are you ready to hear what really happened over there? Join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining me now from San Diego is Tony Perry of the Los Angeles Times. He was embedded with the 1st Marine Division in Iraq. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Tony Perry, thanks for being with us. Before we get on to the soldiers' experiences, how about your own experience? You went to war, you came home. How was it?
It was fine. I went, of course, as a tourist and as a volunteer. I think that makes a difference. I also was able to communicate with my family almost every night through satellite phone, and that made an enormous difference. The Marines that I was with didn't have that luxury, except for the ones that were close enough to me. I could give them my satellite phone, so they were really out of communication with their families, and I think that's the big difference, and that's where the stress comes, saying goodbye to your wife and children and then not knowing when you'll see them next. Mail, snail mail, they call it, was excruciatingly slow. So for a lot of these young Marines, they were totally out of contact with their loved ones. And that is very, very difficult. And very difficult once you return, after you've been out of contact that long, to reintegrate yourself into your family.
Have you been able to talk to some of the men and women whom you were with in Iraq since they came home?
I've talked to some of them. Most of them are doing well. Let's not forget that most veterans will come home and pick it back up, maybe with some slight bump in the road, but they will pick it back up and do just fine. We're talking about a percentage, 15, 20, 25% will have more significant issues to deal with, but there's still the vast majority of veterans will do just fine. But even among those, they find there is a kind of disaffection, there is a kind of alienation and edginess that can creep in. Your frame of reference has changed while you've been gone. The spouse maybe has picked up certain chores around the house and certain authority that wasn't part of the compact when you left. That sometimes is quite difficult. There are children issues, and there's been an outreach program here in San Diego for military personnel and their children to help the children understand what dad has been through, and vice versa, to help dad understand and mom understand what the children have been through.
Tony, did any of the people you were with in Iraq already begin to think what it would be like when they got back home? Was it an issue even before it arrived for them?
Oh, it's a big issue with deployed troops. And one of the biggest issues, let's say it right off, is the fidelity of their spouses or significant others. It preys on the minds of men and women who are forward deployed for months and months and months. As one Marine sergeant told me, fear of your spouse being unfaithful is more terrifying than fear of facing an artillery attack by the enemy. It's something that preys on their minds, and it's a major issue in military families.
Jack Beattie, does it surprise you that this is still an issue? It's not new. It's been talked about in armies for many, many decades now.
Yes, the Dear John letter is certainly a convention of movies, if not of life, about the U.S. military when the soldiers come home and the letters they receive abroad. But you know, Robin, you asked in your opening, does the United States take care of its returning soldiers? And the answer is no. The Bush administration is not taking care of them. The Bush administration has asked for a $10 billion cut in veteran spending, the spending for the Veterans Administration over the next 10 years. They have cut $1.5 billion out of housing for military families. Much military housing is substandard. And when the Democrats tried to get that funding back by changing the tax structure such that the people earning over $1 million a year would only get $83,000 next year instead of $89,000, and that would take care of the military housing, the Republicans would have no part of it. And the administration has now cut $125 million out of school allowances for military children. All this led one Vietnam veteran complaining about this to a California newspaper to say, it's the same old bull blank. They pick you up, use you as soldiers, and then, like a beer can, throw you away.
Don't go away, Jack. Tony Perry, stay with us too. We're talking tonight about the emotional trauma for soldiers returning home from Iraq. Are you ready to hear what really happened over there? You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about soldiers returning home from Iraq and the emotional challenges that they face. Has one of your family been in Iraq? What's their homecoming been like? Do you think that the way the war has been reported has made it more difficult to understand what these men and women went through? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Tony Perry, a reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who was embedded with the Marines 1st Division. On Point news analyst Jack Beattie is with us. We're joined now also by retired Colonel Patrick Sweeney. He's at Newport, Rhode Island. He's now professor at the Naval War College. Colonel Sweeney, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Just look back a little bit, if you would. Is the situation for returning service men and women better now than it was, or worse, would you say?
I don't think it's all that different from the first desert war that we had. I think that Tony hit it right on the nose on the major concerns and problems for the returning service members, and that's really with the family unit. And if there were problems brewing when they left, they have not gotten any better over time, and that's usually where you run into the problems.
You've seen service in many different areas. You've been in Korea, in Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia. You were in Desert Storm. What problems did you encounter?
Well, the first thing is for the children, as mentioned by Tony, for example, my child was born a week before I left for Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and the next time I saw him he was 7 months old, and fortunately still not old enough yet to realize I was gone. But
you were a stranger to him.
That's right, and so I had to get accustomed to him, and he had to get accustomed to me. But that's the nature of the military business. I mean, my father was a career soldier, and I remember meeting him the first time when he came back from the Korean War as a 3-year-old. So that has some long-lasting impressions, I would expect.
A lot of people talk about the difficulty of reintegrating into a family that has found a way to operate without them. Sometimes they feel almost like a stranger in the house.
And I think that's exactly correct, is that the spouse that stayed back has now had to pull the duty for both, had to set the rules within the family and make things work, and the children are used to operating in that regime. And when that returning service member comes back, there's been enough changes in that individual's life, having been in combat and then coming back, and would want to see some normalcy of falling right back in to where he was or she was before. And, of course, it's not the same.
Do you feel, Colonel, that enough is done to prepare servicemen and women for what they are likely to encounter, not so much when they're on the front, but when they're back home?
I can speak for the Army, mm-hmm. and this is an identified item that was occurring. And so, yes, we do address this with the soldiers before they would return back. This is a major role for not only the commander, but for the chaplain. And talking to the families, and on the other side too, the family support groups back in the continental United States, they're being told what to expect from their husbands or wives that are returning from combat, what they've been through, what are some of the expectations, and so there is some preparation for those aspects. But again, that will never negate problems. If there were problems before that service member left, that's not going to solve those problems.
Tony Perry of the LA Times, were the Marines you were with during the war, did they feel that some of that preparation had been useful for them?
Well, at the point I was with them, of course, they were still worried about taking bullets and achieving the mission both in Baghdad and Tikrit. But it is true that the Navy and the Marine Corps both have assembled a wider range of counseling services and lectures and other sessions for both the military service personnel and their families than ever before. I know that the Marines and the sailors who haven't yet left Kuwait or on ships returning are being talked to by counselors and by chaplains and getting them ready for the things that they're going to encounter. And the same is true for the spouses and the children. So there's a big push for what they call the warrior transition phase of this whole thing. And I know that the head general, General Michael Hagee, the commandant of the Marine Corps, came to Camp Pendleton, which sent 27,000 troops to the war. Hagee came and put his stamp on this process as a top priority from what he called turning the warrior into a caregiver. And so in that kind of organization, when the top person says it's important, suddenly it becomes important. So a lot of that is going on right now.
Colonel Sweeney, this was a short war by comparison with some previous wars. Does that make it easier to make that transition?
Well, time is a major factor, as well as intensity of combat. But for these soldiers and service members that are been over there for some time, there's many of them still sitting there that are approaching multiple months. That does have a major impact. If it's a short sortie over there and back, as was our experience in Haiti, it's not quite as bad. But as time lingers on, those problems in at the family, if there were any fissures, those will continue to spread.
When you got home from your various overseas engagements, did you want to talk about it? Did you want people to ask you about it? Did you want to have an opportunity to tell the stories? Or did you just want to put it all in a little box somewhere at the back of your mind and throw away the key?
I think you pretty much just want to relax and get back to your regular life and share really only those insights that that people truly understand, I think, within your family and friends.
And that tends to mean other servicemen and women, doesn't it?
Ah, yes, for the most part, yes.
Jack Beatty, in the past, it's been a problem, hasn't it? People coming home and finding that nobody wants to know, perhaps nobody even values, or few people value what they did. Is that a problem this time, do you think?
Well, not so far, but, you know, our second president, John Adams, kept us out of a war with the French, and there was a lot of agitation within his party for the war. He kept us out, and he wrote about it. He said, "Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war." And it's more and more apparent that this was an unnecessary war, if you define necessary as meaning that there was an imminent threat to America or Britain. And of course, as that outlook gets around, the question is going to be, well, you are back from an unnecessary war, and ought anyone to be guilty about it? Now you say, what should they be guilty of? Well, I mean, there have been 7,000 Iraqi civilian deaths. Now, the ratio is 12 times that in America. That's the equivalent of 84,000 Americans. And someone killed them, and they died in battle, and they died accidentally, nothing deliberately. But young men and women are going to bear that with them. And the society they're entering may, in a year or two, come to regard this expedition as a misbegotten venture and as an unnecessary war, and a war for which America should be guilty. And if that's the case, they're going to bear even more of the guilt. In other words, they're blaming themselves, and maybe the country will even blame them too, as it did the Vietnam veterans most unfairly.
Tony Perry, did the people you were with worry a lot about what people back home thought of the mission that they were engaged in? I know in Britain, where I was during the war, there were a lot of servicemen and women who did say that they cared very deeply about the deep split in opinion that there was back home at that time.
Yes, they did. They worried a lot about it, and I think Jack has put his finger right on it. The most asked question that I got from mostly young enlisted, not so much the senior enlisted or the officers, was, what do the American people think about what we're doing over here. And, of course, at that time, the various polls showed giant support. Now, if that support erodes and if things get to where the American public thinks that the war was a misbegotten adventure, I think there will be, if not blame attached to the service personnel as they return home, but a kind of so-what feeling, and I think that's going to be deflating for them. I think that's going to lead to alienation, and I think that's going to lead to troubles with a much larger percentage of them than we might have thought if American support stayed strong for the mission. I don't know what to do about that. I mean, we would never want to suppress dissent or try and angle American opinion one way or another on that, but don't kid yourself. If American opinion starts to sour on this mission, the people that are going to feel that are the people who served.
Let me then at this point bring in Captain Jennifer Berg, who is at the psychiatry unit at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego, California. Captain Berg, thanks for joining us on the show tonight. What do you say to service men and women about how they should react to public opinion back home when they're engaged in combat?
Well, I think we talked to them about the fact that, you know, they are doing their duty, what they came into the service for, and we really try to get them to focus on their mission and to focus on the people that they're actually with there versus worrying about the opinion. I mean, it's a natural thing to be concerned about it, but, you know, that's something that we try to get them not to focus on. And, of course, when they come back, if, as others have been speaking, there is a shift in opinion, that obviously would be something that people in the mental health field, such as myself, would be concerned about, and we would be prepared to help them cope with.
Have you yet had an opportunity to assess the degree of problems that are being encountered in the aftermath of this latest war?
Actually, so far, what we've seen at Naval Medical Center San Diego is that the numbers have not been that high, but that is what we would expect right now. People are still in their first month or so of having returned. They're still in that positive period. It's not uncommon for people not to see us for up to 6 months to years down the line after being in combat.
Why should that be the case? Many people might have expected that the problems would arise almost as soon as your feet touched the ground back home.
Oh, well, I think that the reason it's probably the case is that people have been, of course, fantasizing about their reunion, what it'll be like when they come home. There may be some problems that come up, but we hope that with all the educational focus that we put out to families and service members, that they're going to be better prepared to cope with those things. And in general, you know, it's pretty normal for people to experience some anxiety, perhaps even some depression, some emotional concerns in the first month after they come home because they're readjusting. It's a shock to the system to come home from months in the field back to your home environment.
Do you tell them that they should expect their family members to be interested in their experiences, to want to hear about them, or do you say to them, don't expect people to be interested because they won't be?
You know, I say everybody's an individual. There are families that are going to be very interested, very supportive, are very much aware, have been doing lots of reading. There are clearly families that are probably not able to cope with that kind of news or that depth of detail. So it's a very individual thing, and we say to people that it's what's normal is going to be what's normal for them in their environment.
We're discussing the emotional struggles for soldiers who are just back from Iraq and their families. You can join our conversation. The number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go back to Colonel Patrick Sweeney in Newport, Rhode Island. Colonel Sweeney, how much of a difference did it make to you when you came back from your various engagements, what the people in your local community thought about what you'd been doing and where you had been?
Well, I would agree with the other speakers is that it would have, an impact on me if they had a negative view as I envision what it was for Vietnam vets returning back. In this particular case, all my receptions were positive. For the smaller things like Somalia and Haiti, they were pretty much localized in military communities, and so we all had a common experience on that, even though I was less enthralled with the Somalia experience.
Captain Jennifer Berg, would it make a difference if the nation said thank you to its servicemen and women for what they did in Iraq? Some form of parade, some form of commemoration?
Yes. I know from experience that certainly service members have told me that that made a difference to them. One of the unique things that I think many people in our country don't even think about is the number of veterans who've said that simply having someone at some point, perhaps a Veterans Day parade or whatever, come up to them and say thank you, whether it was that they served in World War II or Korea, or whether it was they served most recently in Operation Iraqi Freedom, it makes a difference to them.
Jack Beatty, what do you think of that?
Oh, I think that must be immensely important to them. I saw something like that in New York on the September 11th anniversary when the firemen were marching out of the Ground Zero. People in the people in the stands with the rest of us, a woman was there and she dipped into a bag and she had rose petals and she was throwing the rose petals on those firemen. And I thought, well, that's what they deserve. And certainly these young men and women deserve something like that, too.
Tony Perry, the men and women you've been talking to, have they expressed anything along those lines? The feeling that somehow nobody seems to have noticed?
No, just the opposite. This is San Diego, of course, which has the largest assemblage of active duty U.S. military service personnel in the world. And so there is a different communal feeling here possibly than other parts of the country. There has been a great outpouring of appreciation. There have been some small parades. There have been commemorations at the baseball games, that kind of thing, and more to come. And so San Diego is more nurturing, if you will, of service personnel in other parts of the country. And I think it's very important. And the veterans that I've spoken to are very, very thankful for it.
Captain Jennifer Berg, we were talking about the fact that this was a pretty short war by standards of many other wars. Does that mean that you would expect to see fewer problems than if it had been of a longer duration?
Well, no, not really, because it really depends on the individual's experience. I mean, there will be individuals who experience significant trauma despite the fact that it might have been considered a short time. You know, when you're looking at dead bodies or shooting someone face to face, that can seem like hours instead of just a few moments. So the trauma, it doesn't really matter the duration. It's the actual trauma that they went through.
And the trauma comes at the sharpest point from having either killed people or seen people who have been killed.
That's typically what bothers people the most. Obviously, there are people whose trauma will be that their arm was shot off, and they'll deal with that for the rest of their life. But the people that I see years later that come in, it's the fact that probably the ones most troubled are the ones who have killed people.
And they're
still having trouble coping with that, or they've seen their friends killed next to them and they have survivor guilt.
There's no way you can prepare someone for that, is there?
No.
You can tell them it might happen, you can tell them what would happen, but still, when it comes, it's unimaginable.
Yes, I mean, it's like people watching war films and saying, oh, well, this or that one was a little too graphic. That's nothing compared to being there in the moment.
Captain Jennifer Berg, Jack Beatty, Patrick Sweeney, Tony Perry, stay with us if you would. We're discussing the emotional struggles for soldiers back from Iraq and for their families. Are you ready to hear what really happened over there with the ongoing war on terror and the very real possibility that there could be more wars in the years to come? Are the government and the military doing enough for soldiers and their families to prepare them for what war is really like and what coming home really means? You can join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about home is where the hurt is, the emotional struggles for soldiers just home from Iraq and for their families. Are you ready to hear what really happened over there? Has the media's reporting of the war made it more difficult to understand what these men and women went through, what they lived through? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Tony Perry, who's a reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who was embedded with the Marines 1st Division during the war, with retired Colonel Patrick Sweeney, professor at the Naval War College, Dr. Jennifer Berg, chairman of the psychiatry unit at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego, California, and with On Point's news analyst Jack Peaty. Let's hear from one of our callers now. Paul is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Paul, hi.
Hi.
What are your thoughts?
I just wanted to draw the contrast with Vietnam, because a lot of people don't know that more veterans have killed themselves now than were killed in the war. And my own angle on it is that a lot of these kids got lessons in politics.
That's 500.
They found out that their government wasn't right and that no one wanted them there, and they ended up in very morally ambiguous situations where they couldn't tell who the combatants were. And the situation in Iraq is not that different right now. I think a lot of the people coming back are going to have the same kinds of feeling, especially the so-called post-war period, where it's very morally ambiguous. And it's very clear to lots of the people that are there that their mission is muddy and they don't know who the combatants are, et cetera.
Okay, Paul, thanks for that. Captain Jennifer Berg, what do you make of that?
Well, certainly we know that the Vietnam veterans have had a very difficult time psychologically over the years.
But do you see a parallel between their experience and what the veterans now returning from Iraq may go through in years to come?
Well, I think that it's different in that as the people who've come home now, there hasn't been an outpouring of negativity at this point. Generally, it's been very supportive of those coming home. I don't think you're reading stories about people being spit on when they're in
uniform. Did that actually happen?
Pardon? You would hear that during after Vietnam, yes. That's the reaction that people got when they returned home.
Has the military learned anything since those days? Has the military now learned how to prepare its own men and women for homecoming better than those who came home from Vietnam?
Oh, yes. We've certainly the mental health field of all the services has learned from the past. We've listened to the veterans and their families, and at this point in time, we can easily say we have the most comprehensive array of support services that we've ever had. The programs, we've learned to include the family. You know, we've learned to focus on the educational component, and we're coming at it from every way that we can. We do post-deployment screenings within 30 days of everyone coming home.
What does that involve, the post-deployment screening?
It involves going through a questionnaire with them about all kinds of physical symptoms, but also about some psychological symptoms. And that then allows us to make appropriate referrals in the beginning rather than waiting for them to come forward.
But Colonel Sweeney, isn't one of the problems that a lot of service men and women still believe that it's better not to admit to problems of that kind, that they somehow it's expected of them to be, quote, tough, unquote, enough to be able to deal with it?
Well, yes, and that's certainly the case, is that that appears to be a sign of weakness to admit you have a problem, and I don't think that's ever changed. But I think there is one other dynamic that's different between now and Vietnam also, and that's the force that we have. The force we have is an all-volunteer force. These are not draftees that have gone there unwillingly into harm's way or into the service. These are volunteers. These are pretty educated volunteers, too. You have also people that when they come back are not going to have as much problem getting jobs as some of the other folks that we would have had going to Vietnam, too. And though I certainly don't know all the demographics, you do have a different population that's gone to war in Iraq that has to go in to be factored in all of this discussion.
Tony Perry, the Marines pride themselves on being pretty tough. Do the ones that you met, are they prepared to admit to having problems of this kind?
No, probably not. Not immediately, but there are other ways to make sure that Marines and sailors, soldiers get help. They can be referred by their command, by their senior enlisted people that work with them. They can be referred by their spouses, or they can be encouraged to do the right thing and volunteer, drop into the counseling center by themselves. I think a lot will seek services that wouldn't otherwise have done so if you asked them a year ago. I mean, one of the things that my colleague Nora Zamachow and I found when we were reporting this story out was that, as the other guests suggest, the quantity and quality of services being offered by the military to the returning veteran is so much better than it was during Vietnam. But, you know, even at that, though, the specter of Vietnam just hangs like a dark cloud, I think, over the troops. I know that any number of troops that I met seemed to be worried that they would be greeted the way that the Vietnam veterans they had heard were greeted. Whether it's real or apocryphal, the story of the spitting seems to have taken on a life by itself. And I know I talked to a counselor at Camp Pendleton recently, and she said she's dealt with Marines who are worried about becoming the stereotypical cliche, media cliche, Vietnam, whacked out Vietnam veteran. So Vietnam is still very much out there.
Tony, thanks very much for being with us. Tony Perry of the Los Angeles Times in San Diego, California. Patrick Sweeney was with us from Newport, Rhode Island. Captain Jennifer Berg of the Psychiatry Unit at the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. Jack Beattie, our news analyst, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, remembering Katharine Hepburn. This is On Point. One of the last bright lights of Hollywood's golden age went out yesterday when screen legend Katharine Hepburn died at 96. A four-time Oscar winner with striking bones, a finishing school accent, and a penchant for wearing trousers, Katharine Hepburn was known for her feisty independence, both on screen and off. Declared box office poison early in her career, she bucked the RKO star system, bought out her contract, and found more suitable roles. Her comedic timing and confident sexuality shone through in more than 50 films to make her one of the most enduring actresses of the 20th century. Janine Basinger is Chair of Film Studies at Wesleyan University, author of A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960. She spoke to us today about Hepburn's appeal, her long-term affair with Spencer Tracy, and the passing of the Hollywood era.
I think that we all feel this tremendous sense of loss at seeing an icon like Katharine Hepburn go, particularly the women, because she represented something that was so fiercely independent and unique. And she came from a particular background of independence. First of all, her mother was independent, a suffragette, a supporter of Planned Parenthood at a time when that was not common. She was taught as a child to play, to be free, to think for herself. And she followed that pattern through life, and she carried it over not only into the roles she played in movies, but also into the way she ran her career in film. She was an independent spirit, both on and off screen, ran her life by her own terms, dressed the way she wanted to dress, refused to kowtow to the rules of what women's behavior was supposed to be, and she has been a symbol for all of us in that regard and a very reassuring figure for decades.
I believe you're making the worst mistake you've ever made in your life. I think you're going to regret it with more bitterness than you've ever known and for as long as you live.
You're wrong. You're as wrong as you can be. Because I'm thinking of her, and even the doctor is going to know I'm thinking of her.
There's something else. I'm surprised it hasn't occurred to you. The doctor will accept whatever you say to him because he's a terribly sensitive man and because he said that he would accept it. But Joey won't. The most obvious mistake you're making is in underestimating your own daughter. She'll fight you and your whole attitude and everything you do and every argument you ever try to give her. And one thing more. Until today, I would never have believed that I could say such a thing. But when she fights you And for what it may be worth, I'm going to be on her side.
The great thing about the pairing with Spencer Tracy, which of course, as we know, worked off screen as well as on, and that's always a part of it, they simply had chemistry. He brings to her that little touch of democracy, that little thing that brings her down out of the upper class onto his plane, which is we're equals in a universe where everybody is the same, which is a very American idea. There's sex between them. You feel that they really do have electricity between them. And whereas before she might have been a little cold, a little bit too upper class, a little bit too perfect, what he brought to her was that touch of warmth, that heating up of her sexuality, and just a democratizing of her image.
So, well, there's one thing only about us hooking together. That's what I call a plenty long shot.
Nothing wrong with a long shot.
If you come out on top, that's a fact.
We will, Mike.
It's somehow you don't seem to... An upper crester like you and my kind of type that can't even speak left-handed English yet. The whole gizmo, it's hard to believe.
Not hard for me to believe.
You think so?
I know so. It's...
Okay, kid. You got yourself a deal.
Katharine Hepburn was never locked into the sex symbol, the glamour girl, or the selling of herself and her image on her beauty alone. Clearly, she's an astonishingly beautiful woman, but it was never about that in her career. Therefore, when she started to age, unlike actresses who were appreciated for their beauty and their bodies and their youth, her career didn't have to end. She could incorporate the aging process into her persona. And one of the brilliant things about her is that she did that really effectively. For instance, when you see her toward the end of her career on Golden Pond, she's playing a grandmother, the wife of Henry Fonda. It's a starring role. She's really the same woman she was as a young person, simple, elegant, outspoken, edgy, but paired with a great male star in a partnership of equals. And yet she's a very old woman, but she can still be Katharine Hepburn and old.
Hey, I met the nicest couple.
Hmm? Where?
In the woods.
A couple of people?
No, a couple of antelope. Of course, a couple of people. The name is Migliore, I believe.
Migliore? What sort of name is that?
I don't know, darling. Tallard, I suppose. They're up from Boston. They're a nice middle-aged couple, just like us.
If they're just like us, they're not middle-aged.
Of course they are.
Middle-aged means the middle, Ethel, middle of life. People don't live to be 150.
Well, we're at the far edge of middle age, that's all.
We're not, you know. We're not middle-aged. You're old, and I'm ancient.
Oh, poo.
When we lose Katharine Hepburn and we look around, we say, okay, this really is the end of an era. This really is the end of the totally golden period of Hollywood filmmaking. There's really no one of her stature left. There are other women, but they did not ever achieve her level. So she's the last of the truly great stars. There won't be her ilk again. The studio system doesn't exist. Her unique qualities, her very individualistic manner, I mean, it's just not going to be the same. So, you know, as Katharine Hepburn died, we have to say, Hollywood is dead, long live Hollywood. I mean, because there will be other stars, but not of her ilk. Oh, no, it's not going to happen.
Janine Basinger is Chair of Film Studies at Wesleyan University, author of A Women's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960. Katharine Hepburn died last night at her home in Connecticut. She was 96. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Robin Lustig, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.